Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects with our guest, P.J. Leash. He is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and we'll talk with him about how bugs are affected by the weather and why this year was a strange one for the Japanese beetle. And as I talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What types of bugs are you seeing around your home this fall? Are there any insects giving you a headache? How are you dealing with them? Join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. And in that email, you can include a photo if you want to. Maybe you've got an insect that you want to have identified, or maybe you just want to show us what you've got. P.J. Leash, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here, Larry.
So insects, we know, they're cold-blooded, and they can't produce their own body heat. And that probably means the temperatures outside play an important role in their lives.
Yes, absolutely. And you really hit a nail on the head with them being essentially cold-blooded. The weather pattern really has a big influence on them. I mean, we generally don't see too many insects in winter. There's some out there if you know where to go looking for them. But weather in general can have really big impacts on insect populations in the state, which we did see this last year.
What happened this past year?
Well, I like to really look back over not just this year, but some longer-term weather patterns we've seen now for 2 years with some unusually dry conditions, droughty conditions over the last year and a half. It has depended a bit on where you are in Wisconsin. Some parts in the state have now improved. We've gotten enough rainfall and moisture. We've kind of caught back up to normal-ish, but there's still some parts of Wisconsin that are running pretty dry. You go over towards like the Twin Cities area and then far northern Wisconsin up towards like Bayfield County and that part of the state is still running pretty dry. And that definitely impacted certain insects and other related creatures this year. A couple big ones that come to mind would be the spongy moth, previously known as the gypsy moth, but the name's been changed to spongy moth. That one had a heck of a year in many parts of the state, especially from southeastern corner going up towards like Jackson County, kind of west central Wisconsin. If you drew a band connecting those two spots, lots of activity in that area. And that's something that I saw kind of building up over a couple years, again, with the drier conditions. That certainly helped that one out. Another thing that I was expecting to see, and I, of course, did at the Insect Diagnostic Lab here at UW, were spider mites. And spider mites are known to thrive under hot, dry conditions. So when we had those types of conditions, I think it got to a point about mid to late July and early August, I was getting case after case of two-spotted spider mites coming through there. Other things that we're used to seeing we didn't see as many of, like mosquitoes, because we didn't have a whole lot of rainfall the last year and a half, their numbers were generally down. They were still out there. If you were in kind of the wrong spot at the wrong time, you could still bump into decent numbers of mosquitoes, but statewide, they were kind of down with the drier conditions. And ticks, I had very few tick calls and emails this year. So I wasn't getting rumblings of lots of activity out there either.
So the weather itself has a pretty big impact, as you're demonstrating here. And the hot weather, you know, when it comes to gardening, the hot weather tends to bring on more problems in the garden.
It can, Larry, definitely. I mean, it goes back to the concept of insects being cold-blooded. There are certain insects that if it stays warmer or it's hotter, it stays warmer longer, they can continue to reproduce and go through more generations. Aphids would be a classic example of an insect like that. If it's warm, hot, well into the fall, we can have lots of aphids. But if it's cooler, they're just not going to be able to reproduce as quickly. So sometimes certain insect pests can squeeze in an extra generation if they have that warmth.
I've heard it said that cricket chirps could be used to measure the temperature. Is there any truth to that?
There is, Larry, and that's cool. I mean, that's something I remember learning about that, I think, in grade school. There is truth to it. You have to have a specific cricket species, but there's, you know, crickets and grasshoppers and related insects that call, especially at night. You hear that chirping sound, and the rate or frequency of their chirps is temperature dependent. So as you just mentioned, it, depending on the temperature, they're going to be chirping at a certain rate or frequency. So pretty cool that you can judge the temperature from that.
And some say that, let's think about flies for a minute. Flies will swarm during a storm. How do heavy rains or the other end, droughts, affect insect behavior?
Yeah, I mean, we do certainly see that. If there is a storm coming and there's changes in barometric pressure, that can certainly induce a lot of insect activity, especially for some that we may not be fond of, like biting flies and things like that. And it's a pretty complicated situation. Part of it might have to do with activity of other animals as well. If there's a big storm coming, sometimes wildlife can get stirred up from that. And if you're a blood-feeding fly, you know, and wildlife is moving around too, you may be encouraged to move around during a period like that as well.
Let's take Japanese beetles for a minute. Well, you can have them. We'll give them to you. I understand 2022 is an odd year for Japanese beetles in Wisconsin. Maybe comment on that, why that may have been.
Yeah, Larry, if you had asked me January of this year what the Japanese beetle season was going to look like, I would have had my prediction and I would have been way off this year. In general, if you were in the southern half or so of Wisconsin, they didn't seem too bad in many areas. In my own yard, there were some out there causing a little bit of nibbling, but I didn't have to really do any managing of them other than going out and hand squishing them from time to time. But it was really interesting. If you look at Wisconsin map, you go through Eau Claire, Wausau, Green Bay, kind of that Highway 29 corridor.
Yeah.
That's where things were flipped around. You got to that point in the state or north, and there was a lot of Japanese beetle activity in some of those areas. And part of it may be that if you live in northern Wisconsin, you maybe haven't seen a whole lot of Japanese beetles before. Maybe they're relatively new, but also there seem to be decent populations up there causing damage to plants. I was getting plenty of reports from places like Oneida and Vilas County. You go up into northwestern Wisconsin, like Spooner area, reports from up there. We've even had in the last couple of years some reports up towards Bayfield County. So this insect, which isn't native to Wisconsin, it's definitely expanding its range and it's pushing more into northern Wisconsin. So if you were southern Wisconsin, I had folks calling me essentially asking, where are the Japanese beetles this year? And I was saying, you know, probably because of the weather patterns the last year and a half, we're getting a reprieve. But northern Wisconsin, lots of calls from that part of the state. And that's not what I typically expect. It's usually the other way around.
How late in the fall do the Japanese beetles usually stick around?
Well, that's an interesting question. When I had a research position here on campus, I did a lot of hands-on experiments with Japanese beetles, and we'd use traps to collect beetles to be able to conduct our experiments. And I remember trapping some into about the second week of October. And again, that's in Madison area, so southern Wisconsin. At that point, there's really very few stragglers around. In my mind, once we get into September, we're really kind of hitting the end of the season for them. So by about mid-September, they're usually dropping off for the year.
And there's some snow in the northern parts of northern Wisconsin, so we're not going to be seeing any Japanese beetles around there.
No, not at all. I haven't had any reports now in several weeks.
Big picture on this, how do scientists think that climate change is going to affect our insects?
Well, looking at the bigger picture, it's not going to be good. And it's always hard to pick out individual trends. There's going to be some insects that maybe do better. There's probably going to be many that don't do as well and just have a harder time surviving. But again, each insect, you'd have to look at it separately in terms of what their trend is going to be. When you think about climate change, but also the bigger topic of insect declines, we know that insects are declining worldwide for a number of reasons. Climate change is going to be part of that. Sometimes there may be direct impacts of changing climate, you know, shifts in winter temperatures or summer extremes might make it so that certain insects just can't survive. There may be indirect impacts as well. If the weather pattern and climate impacts plants and the insects that rely on those plants can no longer get the resources they need, then they may be negatively impacted from that as well. So there's going to be some direct but also indirect impacts of climate change on insects.
Let's take some questions. Lisa in Madison has one for you. Let's go there. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. I have a quick question about carpenter ants. I have a tree in my backyard that was removed by my arborist, and he said there was like carpenter ants inside the tree. He could see where the wood was eaten away. And then he also said there was like big larvae inside the tree as well. And so I'm wondering, about a month ago, I did call when Mr. Pelletieri was on talking about these mounds that I have in my backyard of ants. So I'm wondering if the carpenter ants got into the ground and that's what was causing the mounds.
Yeah, very unlikely is my impression. We have some other ants that can be really common in yards and landscapes, and these are called field ants. And those are the ones that tend to make sizable mounds in lawns and other locations. Sometimes they're the size of a dinner plate and relatively flat. In other situations, they may be very large, pronounced mounds, sometimes a couple feet across, so very, very conspicuous. And the reason I say it's probably field ants and something else in that situation is carpenter ants really like to nest in rotting, decaying wood. And so I think it's just a coincidence that you had a tree that sounds like it was rotting. You got presence of carpenter ants. You had larvae in there, which were probably something like round-headed borers, which turn into longhorn beetles. Those are very common in trees that are stressed, decaying, and dying. And those are just things that would have been associated with the wood. And then you got the mounds in the lawn, and that sounds like it'd be something different. Sounds like field ants in this situation.
There you go.
Okay, so and the carpenter ants in the tree, like my house is like 28 years old. It wouldn't really, they wouldn't like say move to my house, would they, so to speak, or?
Generally, I wouldn't expect them to. And a reason for that, again, for their primary nests, they're really looking for rotting wood. It also depends a little bit. You know, if you have a tree that is cut down and removed in the span of a day, those ants really are going to be pretty scattered. And especially if during this process of a tree being taken down, the queen dies, that colony is just going to fizzle out because you need her to kind of control things around there.
Yeah. So, and they're not causing, the carpenter ants aren't causing the rot. They are looking for something that's already rotting. So they're not the cause, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I think of them almost more of like a symptom. They are an indicator that there's decaying wood, but they themselves won't go up to a healthy tree and start chewing into it and causing decay. It's the other way around. They go to the decayed wood.
Lisa, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert, our producer today. Tyler Dinner's our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with P.J. Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And, of course, we're talking insects. Glad to have you calling in and shooting your emails to us as well. Lines are filled. Let's go to Connie in Montello. Connie, hi.
Good morning, Larry and guests. I have a question. I've been wondering this for quite a while. I never see grasshoppers or crickets anymore. And I live on the Fox River, and I just think I should have some of those around. And when I was a kid, you'd see them everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And that's an insect I didn't mention earlier, Larry, but with the hotter and really certainly drier conditions we've had the last year and a half, those are conditions that grasshoppers can do pretty well with. If you think about Wisconsin in the Midwest, here in the state, we've got 75 or more species of grasshoppers, and they're usually not considered pests. They usually aren't abundant enough to cause a lot of crop damage, for example, versus if you go out west, say, Wyoming, Montana, grasshoppers can be a very significant pest out there because they have much higher numbers with that climate that is drier kind of continually compared to ours. So actually, based on a lot of reports I've had this year, it seemed like a decent year for grasshoppers out there. I have had more calls and emails about grasshoppers, I think, this year than I've had in any of the years I've been at the diagnostic lab. This is my 9th summer at the lab. So it seemed to be, in many places, a pretty good year for grasshoppers in the state. Again, because of the weather patterns, that's not going to be the only thing. If you look at the landscape around you, if there have been significant land use changes, a lot of houses have been built and changed from agricultural areas, land use changes may be a factor in that as well. But otherwise, it seemed to be a pretty good year for grasshoppers based on reports I was getting.
And the crickets, not so much?
Well, yeah, crickets, I mean, related to grasshoppers, crickets I think of with damp conditions doing really well. So again, the weather might have played a role with that, because if they need damp conditions and they weren't quite getting that, that may have impacted them somewhat differently than the grasshoppers.
There you go, Connie. Thank you so much for calling. Sarah in Middleton, on to you now. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, good morning. So I have a problem in my garden. It appears to have been, the dirt was mounded up. And I thought it was a mammal of some sort this summer, but when I dug into it, I saw a lot of ants, so I put some powder down. It seemed to take care of it. Now I'm finding a mound nearby in the flower bed, and I'm just wondering, and when I mess with the dirt, it's crumbly and dry as if something's been in there working on the dirt.
Yeah.
But I don't see any ants at this time.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, the initial description of a mound made me think of ants, and we just talked about field ants with the first caller today. And that could still be a possibility if it were warmer out.
Oh, we just lost a connection with you there, PJ. We'll try and get that set up. PJ Leash, our guest today, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, talking with him, of course, about the world of insects, and certainly inviting you to join in. I'm sure we'll be able to get that connection resolved here in just a minute. And PJ, are you back with us? Oh, not quite yet. But again, that number, 800-642-1234. And if you'd like, you could also email us. Lori from Exland, I believe, emailed us with a nice photo of a walking stick she found on her route in the village of Eland, I think it is, maybe, not Exland, and wondering about that. So we will get to that, and we will also get to the rest of Sarah's questions and your questions as well once we have PJ back. PJ, you with us?
Yes, I'm here, Larry.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, you were talking about the raised area in the garden.
Yeah, so I was mentioning there's this invasive species of earthworm called the jumping worm, and we do have them in Dane County, including in Middleton area. And when it gets into soil, it really kind of churns up the soil, and it makes the soil look like these little kind of dried out pellets. And so if that's what you're seeing, it may be the presence of those worms that has caused that impact on the soil. So that may be a possibility as well. Usually if you were to dig around and find some of these jumping worms, they are very, very active, and they thrash around wildly when you see them, which is a characteristic way we can help identify them. So that would be something I would keep an eye out for as well. So those jumping worms, but also slight possibility of field ants. So maybe this weekend when it's warmer, take a peek for those, dig down, see if you can find anything, either ants or earthworms. Otherwise, I'd keep an eye on it for next growing season when things start growing again. If we can find the actual culprit and identify it, then half the battle is done in my book. Then we can start figuring out what you might be able to do about it.
There you go, Sarah. Thank you so much. John in Port Wing, on to you now. Hi, John.
Hi, I got a couple of questions. early in the year, in the spring, and sometimes in the fall, right around dusk, I get some delta-shaped moths right after dusk.
Mm-hmm.
Come to the lights, like the porch light. They're kind of a sandalwood color, and there are quite a few of them, and it seems to be right in the 35-degree to 40-degree range. I don't see them when it's warmer or colder, of course. Any idea of a name or what they might be?
Yes, really interesting topic. I can't give you a specific name because there's actually a number of possibilities of what those could be. It certainly sounds like a moth from the cutworm or armyworm family, although that's an extremely diverse family. And by the way, if you think of moths overall in Wisconsin, we probably have 3,000-4,000 different species out there at least. And so some of these can be more active during the warmer months, but there's a number of different species and different genera that can be active in the spring and fall, and they actually overwinter as adults. So we'd have them this time of the year. If it were to warm up, for example, during the winter and we have a very mild day, as the caller mentioned, maybe into mid-30s, something like that, sometimes these moths can be active. In the spring, I'll get reports of some of these moths going to buckets when folks are tapping maple syrup because they're going there for the sugar source. So there's actually a number of different possibilities. If you really wanted to know the exact species, if you are able to snap some photos of those and then email it to me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, I'd be able to tell from a photo and let you know exactly what species that is.
Yeah. And you had another question, John.
My other question is there a readily available or available at all substitute for a diazinon for control of field ants?
Yeah, so diazinon has really been off the market for a while for most uses. I think technically in the state it might still be registered for like cattle ear tags, I want to say. I'd have to check in the DATCAP pesticide registry online. In terms of controlling ants outdoors and especially field ants, the main thing I think of is if you have a nest that is causing a problem in your yard, would be to find a liquid type ant control product. Usually, if you go to the hardware store, you might be able to find something from the pyrethroid group. And if you look at the ingredients for those, they often end in the letters THRIN. So just some examples of ingredient names: bifenthrin, deltamethrin, cifluthrin, cyhalothrin, and so on. There's a whole bunch of them. Chemically, they're very closely related to one another. And usually the matter of dealing with field ants is find one of those that is a liquid, and you read the fine print, and it says you can drench it onto ant mounds. We then need to mix it in a bucket. We want a high volume of water, and then you take a dowel rod or broomstick handle or metal bar, poke it down into that field ant nest, make some channel so that the liquid can soak in deeper, and then you slowly pour some in to those holes in the ground, let it soak in, and then repeat that until you've filled it and used up that bucket of solution that you've mixed up. So that's the general way. And again, that diazinon we're not really using anymore. So that would be an alternative that you could look for at the hardware store.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Mary and Ashland, on to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I had a comment about the Japanese beetles in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Last night I was watching television. I felt something on my hand. It was a Japanese beetle, so they're not completely gone from this area. And the thing about that is I hadn't really seen any all year.
And here's one in your house. All right, there you go. What do you think, PJ?
Yeah, I would wonder in this case if it might have actually been the Asian lady beetle. Those are the lady beetles that like to sneak indoors in the fall, and I've been getting reports of those this time of the year. But the Japanese beetles, those are outdoor plant feeders during the summer months, and those really wouldn't have any interest in coming indoors. The adults don't survive the winter at all. They just kind of die off in the fall. So I almost wonder if it might have been another insect that folks often mix Japanese beetles and Asian lady beetles up because of the similar sounding name.
Yeah, there you go, Mary. Thank you for calling. Take a closer look at it. Those Japanese beetles are kind of a brilliant emerald color, are they not, PJ?
Yeah, metallic emerald, coppery, brownish bronze wing covers with some white spots on them. Actually kind of a pretty insect to look at. If you have a lot of them on your garden plants, you're not going to be happy about it. But up close, they're a cool-looking insect.
Rocky and Madison, on to you. Hi, Rocky.
Hello. Wonderful Wednesday. Thanks for all the info.
You bet.
I've got a question. It might have been 10 years ago. I was walking in the arboretum on a path in Madison here. In the wintertime, there's snow on the ground. I looked down, and it looks like a little colony of insects jumping up and down in the air. And all I could think is this like fleas off of a deer or a rabbit, or what was it?
Yeah.
I've heard of like flea circuses years ago, but I didn't really think they were a real thing. So just wondering if fleas live out in the snow or what that might have been.
Yeah, so this is a creature that you described. It's got flea in the name, the common name. They're not actual fleas, though. What you bumped into are what we would commonly refer to as snow fleas. And they get their common name as snow flea because you find them on snow, especially on milder winter days. And if you look at them very closely, they actually looks like they bounce and jump around, hence the common name of fleas. They're actually technically not insects. They're very, very close relatives of insects. They're from a group we would call the springtails, which are kind of a group of animals that branched off on the evolutionary tree of life just as the insects are branching off in another direction. So they're very close related insects. Even though they have flea in the name, they're completely harmless. They scavenge on stuff like fungal spores, decomposing leaves on the ground in the forest. So if you're in a forested wooded area during the winter months, they can be very, very common.
Rocky, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Open lines, we can get you on pretty quickly with your insect question. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. In fact, Lori from Eland emailed us at WPR.org and sent a picture along with her email. And she saw this walking stick while on her rural route in the village of Eland. Are there different species? She's never seen one quite so big. And in fact, it is pretty darn large.
Yeah, and it's a really cool picture. And I feel walking sticks in general are one of those insects that is so unique that we learn it as a kid, and you're always going to be able to recognize what a walking stick is. Here in the state, we only have a handful of species. I think it's about four species, if I remember correctly. Our commonest one would be the northern walking stick, which usually has a body length of around 3 inches or so. We do have one species that can be even larger than that, although it's not common. I did get a picture of that particular species back in about July or so. Otherwise, the common one that I see photos of is the northern walking stick. If you get into western Wisconsin, Baraboo Hills, Driftless area, any place wooded, they can be somewhat common. One place that I've seen lots of them personally would be a location like Devil's Lake State Park in kind of mid to late summer. If you sit down in the woods, they'll just start walking around and you'll notice one eventually.
All right. Jim in Boston emailed a month ago. He thought he was watching a mini-sized hummingbird on his butterfly weed, but he checked the internet. It turned out to be a hummingbird moth. He's more than 70 years old, and he can't recall ever seeing one. He's from the Boston area.
Yeah, really cool. And those are some of my favorite insects to watch. And we actually have a couple of different species we'd refer to as hummingbird clearwing moths, because if you got them to sit still, which they really don't do, they always seem to be on the move. But if you got them to sit still, their wings actually have a clear portion, so you can look right through it. Those often have a wingspan of a couple inches. And then there's another moth called the white-lined sphinx moth, which also has this hummingbird-like behavior. And that one can have a much larger wingspan. We're talking more of the range of 4 to maybe 5-ish inches. And so that one, due to the size, can also very readily be mistaken for hummingbirds. But all around, cool insects to watch. They're beneficial pollinators. They hover. They go from flower to flower. All around, just something neat to see. And they're good insects to have in your yard or garden.
Nancy in Wautoma emailed, she was overwhelmed with what she thinks is some kind of squash beetle. They ate and ruined most of her squash-type veggies this year. She thinks they gave disease to her tomatoes, too. Or is that a different bug? How does she control them?
Yeah, gosh, it sounds like there may be a couple different things going on here. When I think of squash, one of the commonest insects I think of is a squash bug. These can look definitely beetle-like in appearance, and what they do is they suck fluids out of the squash or pumpkins directly, and so that can cause some damage there. They can also feed on other plant structures. There are some beetles that can also show up and feed on squash. We call those like the cucumber beetles, and there's a couple of species that can look similar that we see in garden areas. The tomatoes, though, sounds like it'd be something different, because usually the pests that are on squash and pumpkins tend to be pretty particular, and they like those plants, and I wouldn't expect them to go and feed on tomatoes. So if you had a disease on your tomatoes, that'd be something to ask Dr. Brian Huddleston about. He's the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic here at UW, and he sees a lot of different diseases that pop up on tomatoes, and a lot of those are just due to things like weather conditions. The spores are out there. It's just a matter of having enough moisture and spores getting to the plant, and then you can get disease popping up. So I'm off the top of my head, I can't think of any beetle-like insect that would be spreading diseases to tomatoes.
Mary in Cross Plains emailed, as of fall, she's finding on the walls of her house an insect that's shaped like a fly but much smaller and has a smoky gray color. Is it something new to the area of Cross Plains?
Yeah, that's a good question. In a case like this, it'd be really helpful for me to see a picture just to get a better idea of what the insect looks like. My suspicion is it may be one of these insects that simply likes to sneak indoors for the fall. And when we start looking at a list of possibilities along those lines, I mean, the common things would be box elder bugs, brown marmorate stink bugs, Asian lady beetles. But there are some other things that sneak indoors on occasion. There's particular insect, pretty small, associated with birch trees, the birch catkin bug. That one can have kind of smoky looking wings. That'd be something I'd be curious to see a photo to see if that might be the culprit. Otherwise, really hard to tell. I doubt it would be something necessarily new to your area, but if you can get some photos, or better yet, if you see one and can actually collect it and either bring it in or mail it in to me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, then I'll be able to get you a definitive answer and let you know what it is and if for some reason it is something newer.
Kurt in Minong has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
My question is, as kids and the lightning bugs, where'd they go? I haven't seen any up in northern Wisconsin in so long. And then, you know, we used to see them all the time. Now they're just like disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah, so a lot of things could be going on with lightning bugs, or fireflies is another name for them. So we actually have probably 20 or more different species of fireflies in the state. They're all going to have somewhat similar habits and biologies and habitat they like. In general, these creatures like damp conditions. They don't want to be in the water necessarily, but they like areas where slugs do well. So think of a heavily wooded area with lots of fallen leaves and leaf debris. That's good habitat for fireflies or other places where we have lots of plants. If you think about the weather patterns, we've had the last year and a half, a lot of areas, a lot of parts of Wisconsin have been pretty dry, which is going to be kind of hard on fireflies or lightning bugs. If you went down in maybe a creek valley where there's more moisture, especially if it's wooded, that would be you know, a location where you're more likely to bump into them. So some of it might have to do with your setting of where you currently are compared to if you grew up somewhere different as a kid, if it's, you know, been kind of built up into suburbs or houses and it's no longer more natural areas. That may be one factor as well. The weather may be a factor. I will say in general, I probably saw fewer reports or questions of fireflies this year, likely due, I suspect, because of the drier conditions in the state the last year and a half. I will say, though, if you were in the right spot at the right time, I had some reports of very, very high numbers of fireflies. Personally, my wife and I and our son, we went up to Bayfield County in early July, and where we were, it was a phenomenal display of fireflies. We were in a very, very wooded area, must have had enough moisture and good habitat for them. I know there were wetlands nearby, so they seem to be doing good, at least in that spot. But other areas, if it were drier or land use has really changed over time, that's probably impacting their populations too. But hopefully if we get more rain the next couple years, I'd expect to see their numbers creep upwards again.
Russ in Monroe, on to you now. Hi, Russ.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I grew up in this area in the 60s and 70s and then left. And I noticed spiders when I was a kid. We were outside a lot. Daddy long legs, wolf spiders. And then I came back after 30 years and bought a home. And I'm seeing a spider down the basement up in the rafters. It's a light little spider with kind of highly arched legs, a little small rectangular body that I don't remember ever seeing as a child. And I'm just wondering, is this something new or did I miss it?
Based on the description, I wonder if you might be seeing one of the types of cellar spiders, and that's spelled C-E-L-L-A-R, like a basement, because they're rather fond of basements and garages and locations like that. And the description seems to fit. They've got kind of these longer legs. They often will just sit in a little cobweb type web, small bodies. We have a number of species. There's at least one non-native species I'm aware of that's in the state. Overall, those can be fairly common, though. If we wanted to know the exact species with that type of spider, you'd really have to get me an adult specimen, and we'd have to take a really close look at it under the microscope to be able to confirm an exact species. But based on the description, I think it's probably one of those cellar spiders.
Thank you, Russ. Appreciate it. Jim and Camp Douglas, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. Couple of just identification questions. Each fall in my lawn at different points in the lawn, I've got an ant hatch that shows ants with wings on them, and I wondered what they were. And then I have like a large bee, almost looks like a mud wasp, that will drill a hole into the ground, come back with an insect in its legs, and then deposit it in that hole. And I'm just wondering, what are those insects?
All right, a couple good questions.
All right, so first, the lawn ants. If you are seeing this ant activity in late summer, usually around, I would say, Labor Day weekend, that is kind of a classic description for an ant we would call cornfield ants. It's a genus Lasius, L-A-S-I-U-S, and some of the species in that group will swarm around that time. So the nests are actually present for much longer periods of time, but that is the time of the year where the winged males and females will leave the nest. They fly around, they mingle, they mate. The new queens go off to try and establish new colonies. And it's often late summer, warm, sunny afternoons. And it's interesting because it's a very short-lived phenomenon. If you were gone that afternoon or evening, you could miss it. It seems to last sometimes only a matter of a couple hours. Flurry of activity, and then they're gone. So harmless, really nothing to worry about, but probably from that cornfield ant group. That's a common name for them, but genus Lasius, L-A-S-I-U-S. The other insect flying into the hole in the lawn, a couple possibilities come to mind. There is one insect called a cicada killer wasp. These could be perhaps mistaken for large bees just due to the black and yellowish banding on their abdomen. Those dig a little tube in the ground. They fly out, they hunt cicadas, which they bring back. That's what they stuff down in the ground to feed to their young. They're a little large in size, perhaps slightly intimidating in appearance, but otherwise harmless. There's one or two other large wasps that can also do somewhat similar habits. There's a great golden digger wasp, for example, that can do that. Those ones hunt more things along the lines of katydids and tree crickets. But the cicada killer would be a top possibility in my mind. If you head to my website for the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, I've got some articles on both cicada killers, great golden digger wasps. Feel free to check those out. Look at the photos, see if you have a match. If not, you're always welcome to email me as well, and I can give you a couple other possibilities to look into.
Thanks so much, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of insects today with PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Lots of callers online. Let's turn to Rick and Eau Claire next. Rick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, good morning. So I originally had a question about a pine insect, but I'm going to switch it to one of a maple species that was chewing on. We had very sizable maple, probably 24 inches in diameter, that was taken down in a storm. And when we were bucking it up into wood splitting pieces, the center of this tree, it was quite sizable, like I said, looked like it was filled with earthworm castings. So when we started splitting it, grubs would just pour out of this thing. And I'm talking the size of my thumb, maybe inch and a half in length. What lays something that big in a dead maple tree?
Yeah, so once I heard we had a large, dead maple, this is something that popped into my mind. But there's certain types of stag beetles which will deposit eggs, and that's really what they like, is larger hardwood trees, maples, but other hardwoods too. And they like it when the inside of that tree is really soft and decaying and almost getting to like a soil-like consistency. That's where you can bump into some of those grubs. So we have one species of stag beetle that can be about 2 or so inches long as adults. That would be my top suspect. We also have a type of scarab beetle, which we commonly sometimes call leather beetles, because they can have a scent somewhat reminiscent of fresh leather. And those can be pretty large grubs in trees like that as well. But simply due to the size, I think it's probably a type of stag beetle larva that you bumped into.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it. Daniel in Minocqua, on to you now. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Larry. Hey, and thanks for having me on. PJ, I had a question about mushroom beetles. I grow mushrooms at home, and these little tiny black and orange beetles seem to lay their larvae on my oyster mushrooms, and the larvae just tunnel all through my mushrooms and ruin them. I wish I knew what they were, and better yet, how to keep them off without using pesticides on my mushrooms.
Okay. And how many mushrooms are you growing in this particular case?
Typically have, I don't know, a dozen logs. I also seem to find them on wild oysters near my house that I collect as well.
Okay.
One thing I wonder about in a case like this, so there could be a couple beetles that come to mind would be helpful, is if you're able to either collect some of them and mail them down to me, I can get you a definitive answer and share some literature on how to potentially manage them. But there's a few suspects I have in mind at this point. In terms of doing something in the meantime for small kind of hobby operations, one thing that can be really helpful is if you essentially have a period of time where you're not actively growing mushrooms. Because if you have a rotation of different age logs and things like that, you may have some that you're harvesting just as other mushrooms are getting started, and insects may leave the ones you're harvesting and go to those new ones. So you're kind of having this perpetual cycle. If there is a way and time to basically break things up, and if you could have say, a couple weeks where you don't have any logs or mushrooms, that may be a way to kind of break this cycle and break the infestation. At least that would be helpful during the colder months when you have these indoors. If it's warmer or if you're doing things outside, it's going to be pretty hard to keep these beetles at bay, but we could consider covering them with some type of mesh netting or almost make like a cage around them might be another helpful approach that you could potentially try as well. But if you can give me some samples or a photo, that'd be really helpful to narrow down exactly what you're dealing with.
Yeah, and PJ, of course, is at the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. You can put that in your search engine, and it'll pop right up. Daniel, thank you. Matthew in Wonder Lake, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Larry. Huge fan. Listen every day. So dig this. I have some beds in the front of my house, a number of tomato plants that I grow, and then I decided to grow Brussels sprouts this year. And throughout the growing of the Brussels sprouts, they're still growing because I don't harvest them until the first frost, there's just been holes on the leaves everywhere, and but they don't, like, whatever insect it is doesn't touch my tomato plant. So I'm just curious, like, what is making all these holes in my Brussels sprouts? And also I have like wild strawberries next to it, and they eat that too. So I'm wondering if it's a leaf cutter kind of ant or something, but yeah.
Okay.
Sure. So when it comes to Brussels sprouts and related crops, you know, cabbage and kale and things like that, there's actually three caterpillars that can be quite common. There's a diamondback moth, the imported cabbage worm. That one turns into those kind of mid-sized whitish butterflies you've maybe seen flying around during warmer days. And then there's also a cabbage looper. So all three of those, the caterpillar stage, can feed on crops like Brussels sprouts. They can chew holes in leaves. Sometimes there's subtle differences in the size of those holes. The diamondback moth, those caterpillars are going to be the smallest out of this batch. Keep in mind, all three of these as caterpillar stages, they can blend in pretty well. They're usually going to be a greenish color. And on the foliage of Brussels sprouts or cabbage, they can blend in pretty well just due to their coloration, offers them some camouflage. But it's probably one of those things. My suspicion is that's why you're not seeing the damage on the tomatoes, because the insects I mentioned are really pretty specific to brassica or cole crops like Brussels sprouts. I have a hunch that the damage on the strawberries could be due to something else. Can't be absolutely certain. If you had a generalist feeder pest like a cutworm, that can feed on often a number of different crops. But my hunch, based on the description on the Brussels sprouts, it's probably one of these common specialists that specializes on brassica crops, and the strawberries probably have something else going on.
Do you anything that Matthew needs to do to control, or don't they cause enough damage to make a difference?
Yeah, it really kind of depends on your particular situation, how much damage you're seeing, if you can actually find the insects, how abundant are they? Another thing to keep in mind at this point in the year, it's getting pretty cool. And that, even if they're still there and not dead yet, it's going to really slow them down. And if their physiology is slowed down, they're just not going to be eating as much. So if they only seem to be on the foliage of Brussels sprouts, you know, that's one thing. If they seem to be directly attacking the Brussels sprouts, and that's maybe a little bit different. If you can confirm that they are indeed caterpillars in this case, which I have a strong suspicion that they are, you could use some very kind of low impact management approaches. Things like insecticidal soap would probably be my number one option for a small vegetable garden. That would be a good way to go after them. If this were earlier in the growing season, I'd maybe consider something like Bacillus thuringiensis. The Kurstaki strain can work well against caterpillars. There's Spinosad as well. All three of those, the soap, Bacillus thuringiensis, Spinosad, those would all be organic options. But for now, I think if you're not seeing tons of damage, if you can do some diligent scouting, some detective work, find the caterpillars, insecticidal soap might be a good remedy for you. That's pretty low impact.
There you go, Matthew. Thanks a lot for calling. Susan in Eagle River, your turn.
Hi, Larry, PJ. I have a beetle that I believe is an Asiatic garden beetle. And I also have blueberries and honeyberries. It devastates my blueberries and honeyberries. I had basically no harvest this year. I am trying to figure out, they emerge from the ground the same time the bees do, so I can't cover my plants. So how do I kill this thing without harming the bees?
Yeah. And Susan, where did you mention you're located again?
Eagle River.
Eagle River. Okay. In that case, I doubt that they would be Asiatic garden beetle. The reason I say that is Asiatic garden beetle, we've only had a few potential reports in the state. We've collected specimens just a few times. That's only from Dane County. I've had a suspected report, I believe, from Green Lake County. If you are down in Illinois, I would say, yeah, that could certainly be a possibility. But given your northern location, Asiatic garden beetle is going to be very, very unlikely in a case like this because we've had no reports or even suspected reports in your part of the state. What I would really suggest doing would be next spring, taking a very, very close look at those plants when you start seeing damage. And that might mean having to go out after dark with a flashlight. If you're not finding any pests during the day, try looking after dark so that we can hopefully figure out who the culprit is. That'll allow us to get a better idea of what we can do about it.
Thanks, Susan, for calling. PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. For now, we'll take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with PJ. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of insects with PJ Leash on the show today. Larry Mueller here. PJ manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always a pleasure to have him with us, and certainly you can join in as we move along today. Ruth sent us an email. PJ, they have what appears to be cluster flies in their newly built cabin in Vilas County. They suddenly appear by the hundreds on the inside of the screens of their screen porch. They vacuum them up and more again appear again soon after. There are not too many in the house itself, although a few congregate on a window that gets a lot of sun. They are told they're probably coming from the attic, so they've set off several bug bombs there. How do they permanently get rid of them?
Yeah, so cluster flies can be a fairly common pest in some parts of the state. And really what these insects are is they're parasites of earthworms outdoors during the warmer months. So during June, July, they're doing their thing out in your yard or in nearby areas. But as fall gets closer, they have the habit of sneaking indoors because they like to hunker down for the winter. Now, in comparison to other insects we're maybe familiar with, like box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles, those get in relatively late. Cluster flies get in a little bit earlier, more like late summer, for example. So when I look at any of these types of scenarios, what can we do to actually help prevent it in the future? The two biggest things would be physical exclusion. And that's what basically we mean by sealing things up well so they can't sneak in. Now, with a new home or newly built construction, usually things are going to seal up pretty well. But depending on when the home was actually finished, you know, if it was still in construction late summer and siding wasn't on yet, that might have allowed them to sneak indoors going forward. Hopefully that would help out. But also it can just be a good practice in general to look at the exterior of your home and look and see, are there gaps in the siding, potential points where these insects or other insects could sneak in? Because if we can identify those spots and seal things up with either caulk, expanding insulation foam, backer rod, better weather stripping, something like that, that will have things sealed up well enough that they can't get in. So that also helps us out. Another common approach for these would be to have the exterior of your home sprayed with an insecticide. And we're not broadcast spraying the entire side of the house, but you would spray basically edges of siding along the base of the foundation, soffit area, spots where insects could potentially sneak in. The idea being that if you can prevent them from getting in, either killing them or repelling them, that will help prevent this issue. Now, at the current moment, you have cluster flies inside in this particular case. Spraying indoors or trying a bug bomb really isn't probably going to help a whole lot. What I would recommend would just be to vacuum them up with the hose attachment, and then hopefully we can do some things to prevent them from getting in a year from now.
Camille in New Berlin will give you a chance. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a Japanese cherry tree that was just about destroyed by those Japanese beetles a few years ago. It looked like lace. And then the next year, we didn't see any damage or any bugs. And my son and I were sitting and looking at that going, I wonder why there's any damage. And just as we said that, a flock of, I believe, the invasive sparrows, English sparrows, flew out of there. And that's why I'm wondering, are any of these birds becoming natural predators to any of our invasive species?
Well, they might be to a certain extent. I have seen in the literature notes that birds have fed on Japanese beetles. I have not bumped into any situations where I have seen a documented case where birds have just been like a top-notch, excellent predator of these and just completely wiping them out. What may be going on in kind of the bigger picture is if that significant damage occurred a couple of years ago. For some parts in the state, Japanese beetles have just been trending downwards for a couple of years now, especially in more southern parts of Wisconsin. In my own yard and garden, if I went back 4 or 5 years, I had to do more to manage Japanese beetles in my own yard. The last couple of years, probably since, 2020, 21, 22, I really haven't had to do much at all. So it may just be some natural population dynamics in your area. The birds might be playing a role in that, but I suspect it probably has to do more with general weather and climate patterns we've seen in parts of Wisconsin.
Here you go. Kellen Sugar Camp wonders how close fire ants are to migrating into Wisconsin. Hopefully a long time away.
you're right there, Larry. They're a long ways off. I would have to pull out the latest map, but they're a couple states away. I want to say Tennessee may have some activity. I think of them mostly down in like Gulf Coast states, southeastern part of the U.S., really quite a good distance from us here in Wisconsin. Although I will share an interesting case I saw a couple years ago, Larry. I was consulted by a colleague at USDA. We had a suspected case of red imported fire ants. I got them under the microscope. We confirmed they were actually fire ants in Wisconsin. What had happened, though, is there was a cargo train that had been down in the southern U.S. And in the battery compartment for the train, there's batteries. There are also some big chunks of wood to kind of hold things in place so they wouldn't shift. The fire ants had moved into there. So this train came up from far southern U.S. There were fire ants in there. They were identified. They were treated. They were wiped out. So we haven't seen them since. But it was just a little interesting story. One of the more exciting cases I've seen at the diagnostic lab in the last couple of years.
Okay. Joy in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Joy.
I have a question on caterpillars on a dogwood bush. They were about an inch long, yellow and green, sometimes black. What I want to know is how to prevent further infestations in this next spring.
Did they eat the leaves or what were
they? Yes, did they ever.
Okay.
So what it sounds like in this case, it's probably not a caterpillar. It's probably an insect that looks very caterpillar-like, and there's one called the dogwood sawfly. Because it feeds specifically on dogwood, this is probably the top dogwood pest that I think of, although they do pop up and cause notable defoliation every once in a while, but in a lot of years, they're just kind of out there at low levels. So it sounds like you may have bumped into high populations this year. What I would recommend for next year is starting in about maybe early July or so. because these are more of a kind of mid and later summer pest. I'd start in early July and just keep a close eye on the shrub. One thing that can be very helpful to scout for these in particular, due to the smaller sizes of dogwoods usually, would be to put down like a drop cloth on the ground underneath the shrub. Or if you have just a piece of cardboard, you can slide under there. Then what you can do is physically shake the plant or take a stick and bounce the plant around and jostle it. Because if there's some of these larvae present, they may fall down onto that drop cloth or piece of cardboard. That's a way you can scout for them and confirm their presence. If you do this next year and you never find any, then my recommendation would be to do nothing. There's no need to spray in a case like that. Now, if you do start to find them and they're present, there are some very easy ways, low-impact ways that you can manage them. One very simple thing would be to use either insecticidal soap or a horticultural oil. Those can kill these dogwood sawfly larvae on contact. You just have to make sure to spray thoroughly. And these insects do often like to hang out on the undersides of leaves. So you'd really have to get your spray wand in there and make sure to thoroughly spray the undersides of leaves. But that would be a very low-impact way to take care of those.
Thank you, Joy, for calling. Mike from Algoma emailed. He's got an old apple orchard that has bugs that he has not been able to control for 40 years, so he gave up trying. But this year, Mike was able to eat bug-free apples for most of his trees. Does he think this? Do you wonder if is it weather-related, perhaps?
It very well could be. That would surprise me a bit if you had a decent-sized old orchard and the insects were just kind of running rampant for a lot of years. There's probably still some around, would be my suspicion. But any year that we get some extreme weather patterns, droughts and, you know, winter weather, summer weather, that can certainly impact insects. So you might have gotten reprieve this year. I wouldn't necessarily expect that again next year. Maybe you'll get lucky. If you do go forward and you start seeing insect activity, one approach you could try, because it's going to be hard to really manage a whole bunch of trees and really suppress insect populations, there's a technique called bagging, where you actually put a bag around the developing fruit and you nip off the bottom corner so any condensation or liquid can drain out. And then you have a physical barrier around those individual apples, so they're protected from insect damage. So that might be something that you could try if in the future you start seeing insect activity to start picking back up and damaging your fruit again.
Robin emailed about leafhoppers and froghoppers. Wonders if you have a good resource for helping her ID them. She wonders how many different hoppers we have in Wisconsin and are they any invasive. She doesn't have any trouble with them. She thinks they're adorable, as a matter of fact. She sees many of the candy-striped leafhopper and one or two different frog hoppers, but would like to get better at understanding them.
Yeah, really cool insects and fascinating. They don't get a whole lot of attention compared to some larger, flashier insects, but these tree hoppers and leaf hoppers, in terms of identifying them, my general suggestion would probably be to try some of the general insect field guides. There's also some smartphone apps. There's a website called iNaturalist, which has an app called Seek, S-E-E-K. That's something you could kind of play around with as well. A challenge with the smartphone app, so it uses the camera from your phone, and in many cases, the tree hoppers and leaf hoppers are very, very small. And so really identifying those isn't going to be feasible. And even if the app tells you something, I'm always a little suspicious of if that's correct or not. A problem with the leaf hoppers especially, it's a very, very diverse group. Even getting them under the microscope takes a lot of specialized understanding of they have specialized anatomy. You really need a high power microscope. You got to run through some kind of older keys that aren't very user friendly. So it's a very challenging group to identify. There are certainly some members that you can identify more easily, like those candy striped ones. Another very common one, potato leafhopper, migrates up here from the southern U.S. each year. Those are neon green, and they'll show up at like your porch lights at night. For a lot of the other ones, though, they're kind of beige or brownish and can be notoriously difficult to identify. But some of the general insect field guides might help you identify at least some of the tree hoppers, which tend to be a little bit bigger and more diagnostic in their appearance.
Jim in New Glarus called, but couldn't stay with us, and wonders why was it such a good year for Chinese mantis? Early in October or late September, they saw five of them in their yard. And I might add that Jill Nadeau also mentioned in the Watertown area she saw one as well. And I'm understanding is they're invasive, are they not?
Yeah, I mean, you could probably have a discussion about, you know, terminology. I mean, they're not native to our area. We have two mantids we see, the European and the Chinese. Neither are native here. Are they actually, you know, invasive, causing harm to a certain extent? Perhaps, but that's another discussion we'll save for later. In general, in terms of their dynamics, though, what we have seen maybe the last couple winters is I don't really recall super cold, hard polar vortices coming our way. With these mantids, they often lay eggs in very exposed locations, and they're not terribly cold adapted. So if we get a really cold polar vortex, that often kind of knocks them south, if you will, and they have to move up here again from places like Illinois. Now, also a factor this year might have just been some of our weather patterns. If we had winds that were carrying things northward from the south of us and conditions were good for overwintering, they might have just been kind of pushing northwards out of Illinois. I do see that every couple of years. I will also kind of confirm the reports we just heard about at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. I had lots of reports this year, especially in August, September, I think maybe even into early October from southern Wisconsin, as far north as about Sauk County, but Dane County, Rock County, southeastern Wisconsin, lots of reports from those areas this year. So definitely a good year for mantids.
Yeah, for sure. Ron in Whitefish Bay actually has a question relating to praying mantis, I believe. Ron?
Yes. Hi. I had a praying mantis in my garden this year. And she did lay the egg cakes. So do I leave that outside all winter long and hope for the best, or what goes on with that?
Yeah, so if I remember correctly, Whitefish Bay, you're pretty close to Lake Michigan, aren't you?
Yeah, right on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because with the pattern I see of mantids in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, but then sometimes up the eastern coast along Lake Michigan, because it helps moderate the climate. So I will get reports from Door County on occasion. In your particular situation, you probably could just leave them in place because your proximity to Lake Michigan is probably going to buffer the winter climate a little bit compared to inland 100 miles, for example. Otherwise, you could alternatively consider removing that and putting it in a slightly more sheltered location. So if it's on, say, a twig, you could perhaps prune that twig off. You could put it maybe in a container and put that container in like an unheated garage or unheated shed. You wouldn't necessarily want to bring it indoors because they may essentially wake up, if you will, and think it's spring and start developing in December. Well, you're not going to have food for them at that point. But it's probably okay in your location to leave them be. Otherwise, you could consider moving them to a sheltered location where they can still experience the cold and basically keep them in that dormant stage, and then they would emerge next spring. But Interesting observation and pretty cool that you got to see an egg case in your own yard.
Yeah, absolutely. Ron, thanks. Mike in Galesville, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. What's on your mind?
Yes, powder post beetles. I had a poplar tree that fell down along the edge of a wood several years back, and then I cut it up with intentions of using it for campfire. I left it lay out there for several years and then brought it into a wood-framed building. Sometime after that, I discovered I had powder post beetles in the building. Did that come in with the wood, or how do they get introduced into a wood-framed building?
Yeah, good question. It is possible that those might have been brought in with that firewood. Anytime you have standing dead trees or trees that have been cut into firewood, powder post beetles can potentially go to those. And so that's a potential route of introduction. Sometimes the powder post beetles could also simply find their way in by other means. So this may be a situation where we might not be able to tell you for sure how they got in. But it does make me a bit suspicious when you had that firewood that you brought into that wooden building.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Ruth emailed, they live in Green Bay and had an infestation of Asian jumping worms. Any advice on how to get rid of them?
Gosh, I wish I had some, Larry.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Those jumping worms are a tough situation. We've now had them in the state for a decade or so, thereabouts. And we really don't have any good ways to eliminate them. And that's probably the number one question I get about jumping worms. How can you get rid of them? Historically, there had been at one point in time a fertilizer product called Early Bird, which contained certain plant extracts and oils, which had some natural soap-like properties to them. And you could use this fertilizer, and it seemed to irritate the jumping worms, and that seemed to kind of cut down on their populations. That product has not been on the market now for several years. So at this point, we really don't have any remedies to eliminate them entirely. You could consider, you know, hand picking them as you see them, but you could sit there and, you know, pick earthworms all day if you have a very high population of jumping worms. So no way to really eradicate them. That doesn't mean there might not be something down the road, but at the moment, our main message is try not to move soil and plants around so we can at least limit the spread. But unfortunately, that's about all I've got for you.
Edna in DeSoto wonders if there's a safe product for the lawn to kill deer ticks to keep them off the dogs and people. Edna says deer come into the yard nightly.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, for lawn products, my colleague, Dr. Susan Paskowitz, who's our medical entomologist, and her team of researchers, they have done some work with the standard lawn care products and found that those can help with ticks. It also depends on your individual situation. So if you have your home surrounded by turf grass area, and then you have woods around it, one concept would be rather than treating your entire yard, you may be able to treat kind of a band or ring where the lawn butts up against the woods, because that is likely where the ticks are coming from. And some studies have shown that where you can treat just the edge of your lawn, and that may be able to help reduce ticks as well. So that's something that you could consider, a standard product from the hardware store that you'd use to treat other insects and pests in your lawn, either granular or liquid. That could be something you could consider. Those products, in terms of animal and human safety standpoint, just make sure to follow all the directions. Some of them may say keep off until it's dry, for example, if it was a liquid that you applied. So just make sure to follow those instructions as well. And also, if you're only doing this once in spring, that's different than if you were doing it, say, every month or something like that. So really, you only need to do it one time, usually early in the season, and that may be able to help you out a bit.
And Mary in New London emailed us a picture. She says this insect was abundant in her yard in Outagamie County in September and early October. Wondering what it is. Can you see it, PJ?
I'm trying to see which one that is.
The first one in a long string of Mary.
Yes. Yeah, so Mary from New London, this one was the brown marmorated stink bug. this is one I mentioned earlier in the show. It has habits kind of like box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles. These like to sneak indoors for the fall. So as we get into this time of the year, we start getting some frost. That's a signal to them winter's coming. They like to hang out on the side of your house and try and sneak in through nooks and crannies and cracks and crevices.
PJ, thank you so much. Always a great pleasure. We dealt with a lot of calls and emails today, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be back, and we'll talk with him again. Sorry we didn't get to all of the questions. Tomorrow on the show, get your snow tires and your ice scrapers ready. We'll talk about how to get your vehicle ready for the winter. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.